So in our series through the book of Genesis, this is message number 34, and the title of this message is Happy, Sad Ending. So we'll be looking at Genesis chapter 33, and to start, I'm going to read verses 1 to 3. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children unto Leah, and unto Rachel, and unto the two handmaids. And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. I do usually try to verify the accuracy of quotes and things like that I use. And I've heard a quote for years, and I've heard it attributed to all kinds of different people, which is usually a bad sign, about worry and about how much that we worry about that never actually happens. So I decided to do a little research and see if I could get to the bottom of that. And what I found was that quote being used with all kinds of different percentages, some in the 70s, some up into the 90s percent of things that we worry about that never happen. And as I looked on these different sites, many of these were presented as stats that had been the result of scientific studies. I could not find any names of such scientific studies or any information about them, and so you can just take that for what it's worth. So I wasn't really able to verify the quote about worrying that I was looking up. But it is certainly true, and I'm sure that you can acknowledge this in your own life, that at least some of the things that you have spent time worrying about never happened. Or at least they never happened the way that you worried about them happening. They actually maybe turned out well. I did come across a lot of different quotes about worrying that was pretty interesting. For instance, Mark Twain, who's, you know, the famous novelist from Missouri, he said, "I've had a lot of worries in my life, most of which never happened." I thought that was a pretty good quote. Another well-known writer from Missouri, Dale Carnegie, wrote a book titled How to Stop Worrying and Start Living. And you find all kinds of quotes from him, I guess, from that book about worrying. So there's plenty of his quotes floating around. Of course, Dale Carnegie is most well-known for his book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. One time I publicly stated that I had read that book, and at least one member of the congregation laughed out loud, and then several others could be seen stifling laughter at the thought that I had read the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. But I have. Well, the point is, we can certainly be wrong about a lot of things. We can certainly assume a lot of things and worry about a lot of things that never come true, or they're just not as we think them to be. And that is the case with Jacob to some extent, as we come finally to him being face to face with Esau after they had been separated for over 20 years. Now, in chapter 32 that we looked at this morning, we had this prolonged preparation for Jacob to meet Esau. And Jacob had left behind his conflict with Laban, and the conflict with Esau was looming before him. So it had been over 20 years again, and since Jacob had fled Canaan for Haran, and now, of course, he's doing the reverse. He's leaving from Haran and going back to Canaan. And he left from Canaan under the shadow of Esau's anger at his means of acquiring the birthright and the blessing of Esau. Well, Jacob demonstrated that he was obviously worried about meeting Esau, and his words and his actions all show that to be the case. He was worried about this meeting. He was moving forward by faith in God's promises, but he was clearly worried about it. Now, the chapter highlights different aspects of Jacob's story, actually. Jacob had grown wealthy. He had a large family. He had a large household of servants. He had many flocks and herds. And he gave what seemed like an embarrassingly large gift to Esau, over 500 animals that he sends ahead to him. So Jacob had clearly also grown in faith, as his prayer and his encounter with the Lord show in chapter 32. Now, the beginning of that chapter refers to the camp of the Lord's army of angels, foreshadowing, obviously, Israel's encampment and journeys through the wilderness. But here in chapter 32, it also serves as a visible reminder that God is with Jacob. God has been with Jacob, and God will be with Jacob. And throughout Jacob's story, actually, the most prominent feature that is being emphasized by Moses in Jacob's story is God's faithfulness to his promises. That is what we cannot, must not miss. He is with Jacob to protect, to preserve, and to deliver him. He's with Jacob to bless him in order that he might become a great nation according to the promise that he made beginning with Abraham. So now as we come to chapter 33, we get the account of finally of the moment. Moses has been building up to this as we've been going through Genesis, and Jacob and Esau finally meet. They finally come face to face after over 20 years apart, after what happened with the blessing and Jacob pretending to be Esau and getting the blessing from Isaac and all of those things. And Esau had vowed to kill Jacob. Finally, they're coming face to face. So as we read this chapter, you notice that Jacob, he continues to proceed very cautiously and very carefully in everything that he's doing. And it might seem that he's overthinking things to a degree. Esau's reaction in the chapter, of course, is just surprising. He seems to have overcome his jealousy of Jacob and expresses that he's fully satisfied with what he has. And, of course, he has a lot by this time. Moses does give us some ironies in this chapter as well as some foreshadowing of the future. So we want to look at this in two parts. You have verses 1 to 11 where you have the reconciliation between Jacob and Esau, and verses 12 to 20 where we see Jacob settling in Shechem. So let's start here in the first part with the reconciliation of Jacob and Esau. Read again verses 1 to 3. And Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau came, and with him 400 men. And he divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids. And he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground seven times until he came near to his brother. So Jacob now has seen Esau. Esau is within sight, and Esau has this large company of men with him that are coming toward him. And of course, Moses is allowing, as you read this, you can see that Moses is allowing this tension to build concerning Esau's intentions, because he really hasn't revealed that yet. If you're familiar with the story, obviously you know what happens between them, but at this point, if you're reading it and you're unaware, that tension is just building up as they keep getting closer and closer. And it almost seems like it's been drawn out or at least slowed way down at this point in the account. And Jacob seems to be still worried about this meeting at this point. And he further divides his family up. Now that Esau is within sight, 400 men that are with him. And you have to remember that Esau was not a farmer. Esau was not a shepherd. Esau, that's not how that he has gained his wealth. Esau was a hunter. Esau was no doubt something of a warrior. And the prophecy that went on Esau from Isaac was that he would live by the sword. And so that is how he has accumulated his wealth. And so he's coming with a band of armed men, a large company of armed men. And Jacob is still very worried about this, so that he divides his family up further. And of course, Moses points out for us that Jacob makes this arrangement so that you have the handmaidens are first with their children, and then Leah, and then finally at the end you have Rachel and Joseph in that last spot, which presumably would have been the safest spot if they're heading toward each other to meet. So Jacob himself, though, now he goes out in front, and he's going to go out and to meet Esau ahead of the procession of his family behind him. And the word that's used here for bowing is actually a word that indicates him being down, bending down, forehead to the ground. It is obviously a subservient act. It is an act of deference. He bows seven times, Moses points out, which most likely was showing a customary deference that a servant would show to a master in those cultures in that time. So his actions demonstrate that there has been a change in Jacob. And obviously, he has no desire to fight against his brother. I mean, everything that Jacob has done has been to prepare for the worst and sort of to hope for the best. He's hoping that his brother can be appeased and, you know, there not be any conflict between them. But he's preparing for that worst case scenario if there is. And this is also somewhat ironic that Jacob comes bowing before Esau. If you go back to the blessing in chapter 27 and verse 29, when Isaac blessed Jacob, thinking that he was Esau, one of the prophecies of that blessing was that the nations and his mother's sons would bow down to him, to Jacob. So the blessing that he received and the prophecy that came on Jacob at that time was that essentially your brother will be bowing to you, and here he is bowing to Esau instead in hopes of reconciling with him. And Jacob is fully sincere and ready to take even a subservient role to his elder brother if that needs be. Look at verses 4 to 7. And he commanded them, saying, chapter 33, verse 4. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are those with thee?" And he said, "The children which God hath graciously given thy servant." Then the handmaidens came near, they and their children, and they bowed themselves. And Leah also with her children came near and bowed themselves. And after came Joseph near and Rachel, and they bowed themselves. So Esau, again, has a surprising reaction. Jacob is approaching Esau from a very almost ceremonial standpoint, and is being, you might say, very courteous and very customary in the way that he's approaching Esau. Esau doesn't stand on any ceremony. Esau doesn't worry about any custom. He runs to meet Jacob, and the word that's used there means that he just rushed forward to meet his brother. And he acted the part of a family member after a long absence. He hugs his brother. He kisses his brother. And the two men weep with one another at this reunion between them. And again, a very surprising action on the part of Esau. And he saw then Jacob's wives and his children, and he inquires after them. And so Jacob introduces his family to his brother, and he acknowledges that God has given him his family. And the word that he used for graciously given is a word that means to bend or to stoop down. It's a word that indicates some act of kindness that is bestowed from a superior to an inferior. So it's a condescending act, not in the negative sense of condescending, in the positive sense of condescending. It's a condescending act of kindness, and graciously given is a good way of expressing that. And then we see verses 8 to 11. And he said, "What meanest thou by all this drove which I met?" And he said, "These are to find grace in the sight of my Lord." And Esau said, "I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself." And Jacob said, "Nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that is brought to thee, because God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough." And he urged him, and he took it. So Esau questioned Jacob about what had to seem an elaborately arranged and extravagantly furnished gift caravan that Esau met with, as he had them to show up at in intervals with all of these different gifts. And he uses that word translated there, droves. What do these droves mean? And it's a word that does indicate a large company, a large procession. And in other words, in Esau's words, he's sort of hinting to the fact that this is such an extravagant, this is an over-the-top gift. And he's inquiring of Jacob, what's the purpose of it? Now, you notice how that Jacob continues to speak to Esau. He still is carefully showing respect. He's carefully showing deference to his brother as the elder brother and as a superior, continues to address him as Lord or Master. And he confirms that they are gifts intended to find grace in his sight. And what this amounts to is an acknowledgement on Jacob's part. It amounts to something of a confession on Jacob's part that he has stolen from Esau. And so it is an act where he is seeking a restitution, that Esau would essentially be appeased with this restitution, that there could be reconciliation between them and no further conflict between them. Now, when you look at verse 9, you get Esau's words, and of course, we see he addresses Jacob as my brother, so he continues to sort of play the part of, you know, this loving family member at a reunion of one that he has, you know, he's long been parted with. And he says, I have enough, my brother, keep that thou hast unto thyself. So he acknowledges the gift that Jacob has offered, and he declares that he has enough. Now, it's hard not to see in this little exchange right here that there are sort of some, and I hesitate to say hidden references, because I don't think it's hidden as much as it's just sort of unspoken. And maybe you've had that sort of an experience in your family where there's been some rift, some problem, and you've been able to resolve it without really, you know, bringing it all up and hashing it all out again and everything, and everybody knows what's being talked about, and you know, it's being apologized for and it's being forgiven. And I hope that you've had some of those experiences in your family, because the alternative is not good. But nevertheless, there's a almost an unspoken aspect here in this exchange that they're both acknowledging what has happened between them in the past. And notice how that Esau suggests, keep that thou hast unto thyself. He suggests to Jacob, you keep what is yours. And Esau says, I'm satisfied. I have enough. Esau has done well, and he's satisfied with it. Now, Moses emphasizes in this exchange that Jacob is just urging him to take this, and that is why ultimately that Esau accepts the gifts that he has given. Now, he says that he urged him, and so he did take it. So there doesn't seem to be any insincerity on the part of Esau, you know, that he's sort of refusing or trying to enter into some kind of negotiation at all. In fact, he takes the gift and he doesn't offer any sort of reciprocation. So he is receiving the gift. Again, it's sort of unspoken, but it's understood that this is an offer of restitution to Esau. And his receiving it the way that he does indicates that he's receiving it as such. He's not going to hold anything against Jacob. He's not going to require anything further against Jacob. In other words, it's going to be considered as a matter that's settled between them. And then Jacob references seeing Esau is like seeing the face of God. And there's no indication here that he had told Esau about the previous night's encounter, because he had spent the night wrestling with the Lord. He at daybreak they separate, and now he is during this day that has followed, he is coming face to face with Esau. And he says that it's like coming to face to face with God. So Jacob is obviously here still very much affected by the wrestling match, and by realizing that he was face to face with God, and yet he lived. You know, just like when he asked his name, and he said, Why are you asking my name? You know, Jacob, don't you know who I am? And obviously he realizes that as he goes on later there in chapter 32, when he acknowledges, I've seen the face of God. And so it's obviously affected him. I've seen the face of God. I have physically grappled with God in a human form. And yet I have lived. I have survived that experience. And of course, he obviously would acknowledge that that was by God's grace that he survived that experience. And so now he's saying with Esau, this one whose face he has been so worried to see for so long. And obviously, even right up to the very last moment, he is concerned that if he comes face to face with Esau, that he's going to die. And so he has survive. So he's making a comparison here that seeing Esau's face and this encounter that he had with the Lord, because he has lived, he has been spared. In other words, I would think it would be another acknowledgement like what we have previously seen, that he would say, I'm not worthy. In other words, this is a grace that I have received beyond all expectation, that I have seen the face of God and lived, and now I have seen the face of Esau and have lived. Now the word for enough, now this is interesting that Jacob uses in verse number 11. He says, God hath dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. That's actually a different word than the word in Hebrew that Esau used for enough. And the word that Jacob uses for enough here, It is a stronger word. It indicates something to the effect of, I have it all. I have everything. Not just I have enough, I'm satisfied, I'm content. I have everything. I have it all. And of course, this is the result of God's grace, as he is saying. Now, Jacob is not here attempting to one-up Esau. Esau says, just keep your gift. I appreciate it. I have enough. I'm very well taken care of. I have enough. I don't need it. And so Jacob's in turn saying, well, you have enough, but I have it all. Well, it's not that Jacob is trying to one up Esau by a comparison of wealth. But what Jacob is acknowledging here actually is by faith, because he's acknowledging that God has given him something far beyond earthly wealth, and that there's nothing that could be given to him greater than that. What could be added to me, in a sense, Jacob is saying. I have it all. God has dealt graciously with me. I have it all. What could be added? What more could I receive, or what could Esau or anyone else on the earth offer that would be better or more than that? So Jacob has learned contentment. And again, he is here showing how that he is resting in the promises of God. Again, it's not a competition between him and Esau at this point, but an acknowledgement of God's grace. And I would go to say, based on the previous chapter as well, as an acknowledgement of Jacob's unworthiness. And I think he has shown that in his attitude toward his brother, toward his humility and a repentant attitude even that he has shown. So, having reconciled with Esau, then we come to the second part of the chapter, which shows ultimately their parting and Jacob settling in Shechem. Let's look at verses 12 to 16. And he said, this is Esau speaking to Jacob, let us take our journey and let us go, and I will go before thee. And he said unto him, my Lord knoweth that the children are tender, and the flocks and herds with young are with me, and if men should overdrive them one day, all the flock will die. Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before his servant, and I will lead on softly according as the cattle that goeth before me, and the children be able to endure until I come unto my Lord, unto Seir. And Esau said, well, let me now leave with thee some of the folk that are with me. And he said, what needeth it? Let me find grace in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir. So Esau offers now to escort Jacob to his home in Seir. And Jacob, you notice, he still is being very careful. He's being very respectful and deferential toward his older brother. And he is delicately declining this offer that Esau has made. And he cites the fact of his herds with the young and with his family, with his wives and children and so on. And they have need to travel much slower than what Esau and his company can and will travel. So Esau offers then to leave some men with him. Well, I can leave you some men. They can go with you, sort of be an armed guard and an escort to see you safely through this country. And Jacob delicately refuses this offer as well. Now, as we read this part, it's not clear why Jacob refused these offers. It could be that he wanted to be careful that he would not be indebted to Esau in any way now that they were square, so to speak. You know, they've made a reconciliation, they've acknowledged a restitution, and they seem to be on good terms, and Jacob wouldn't want to be indebted in any way. Could be. Could also be that even though they were reconciled, Jacob is still concerned and perhaps doesn't trust Esau fully and what his intentions are. Well, Moses doesn't give us any indication that when Esau, we see him in verse 16, he rides off for Seir. And when he does, he just rides on out of the narrative, except for just a bare mention at the death of Isaac. So, in other words, Moses isn't giving us any indication in this account that Esau has any sort of ulterior motive, that he has any sort of ill will or design for Jacob and that these offers are anything less than sincere. He doesn't give us any indication of that. But nevertheless, Esau, they do part ways and Esau rides off. The chapter ends here with verses 17 to 20. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built him a house and made booths for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came to Shalem, a city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram. And he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought a parcel of a field where he had spread his tent and at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it Elohi Israel. So Moses doesn't offer us any explanation here for why Jacob did not follow Esau to Seir. Jacob, in fact, went the other way, eventually to come to Shechem. And we just don't have any explanation for that. Jacob buys a part of a field in Shechem, reminiscent, obviously, of Abraham's purchase of the cave of Machpelah. And in fact, this is the land that Jacob buys here. It is foreshadowing the future hope of Israel, because this is where Joseph's bones, in fact, will be buried when the Israelites make it there in Joshua chapter 24 and verse number 32. And he named this altar, and essentially this name means El is the God of Israel, the only use of this name in the Bible for God. And his settling in Shechem also sets up events to come. And just sort of as we think ahead, Jacob's life is certainly not clear of conflict, even though this has been a better than hoped for resolution with Esau. He still yet has many, many hard days in front of him. So as we think about chapter 33, and you look at it on the surface, the story here of Jacob and Esau has a happy ending. Jacob showed a lot of worry and a lot of concern about meeting Esau. And it appears here as if perhaps it was mostly unnecessary on Jacob's part. The change in Esau is surprising, and it's really against reasonable expectation. With all the care and the trouble that Jacob went to, he obviously was not expecting this reaction from Esau. So it would seem that Jacob was expecting, at worst, there to be a fight, there to be some sort of battle, or at least there to be some sort of extreme negotiation, that Esau would want some sort of a settling of accounts with Jacob. And maybe he thought he might be heading for some sort of a covenant like he ended up having with Laban, where they didn't exactly part on good terms, but sort of had agreed to cease hostilities toward each other. So instead, Esau acts like a brother happy to see Jacob, willing to let the past be in the past, to consider things as good. Moses, again, didn't give us any indication that Esau had an ulterior motive or was acting in any way untrustworthy or insincere. He just doesn't give us that indication at all. And so Jacob and Esau seem to part on good terms. And God has brought Jacob back peacefully to the land of promise, just as has been promised. So again, the story of Jacob and Esau here has a happy ending and a reconciliation between the brothers, and at least the salvaging of some sort of a relationship between them. But this ending is the ending of Esau's story, really. He doesn't really appear or figure into the narrative much. I mean, he has a brief appearance there at the death of Isaac, but he really doesn't figure into the account after this, as Jacob and his family will be the main focus of the rest of the book of Genesis. So this is the ending of Esau's story. And though in some ways it's happy, it's also not without sadness. It seems that Esau had changed, and he expressed to Jacob that he was satisfied, that he had enough in what he had received. In other words, he has no reason to be jealous of Jacob. He has no reason to covet anything that was Jacob's, no matter how he had come by it. He has no reason to want and desire all that. So in that case, that seems very positive. That seems like progress on the part of Esau. But we have to remember that Moses commented earlier concerning the birthright in chapter 25 and verse number 34, that Esau despised it. And the writer of Hebrews wrote in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 14 to 17, "Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord, looking diligently lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled, lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright. For ye know how that afterward, when he would have inherited the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place of repentance, though he sought it carefully with tears." So Jacob may have, in the earlier part of this account, been mostly interested in material wealth, but Jacob had come to understand the true value of God's blessings when he said that he had everything. He had it all. He had come to understand the true value and nature of God's blessings. And so the sad ending is that Esau wanted no part of Abraham's faith. He despised the birthright. The writer of Hebrews called him a profane and unrepentant person. So even though he had perhaps experienced some personal growth and some personal satisfaction at the wealth that he had gained, so that he no longer needed to compete with Jacob, it really is a sad statement when Esau says, "I have enough." Because we know what he didn't have. And what he didn't have was faith. And even though we can look at Jacob and we can find all sorts of flaws and problems with him, the Bible clearly shows us that he did believe. He did have faith. He did come to understand the true nature of God's blessings and valued it more than earthly wealth. Esau wanted no part of Abraham's faith, and he was satisfied to have enough of this world's goods. And this is actually what Moses would end up warning that second generation of Israel on the plains of Moab about. And he wrote this in Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 7 to 17. "For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains, and depths that spring out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of oil, olive, and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it, a land whose stones are iron, out of whose hills thou mayest dig brass. When thou hast eaten and art full, Then shalt thou bless the Lord thy God for the good land which he hath given thee. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in not keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes which I command thee this day, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hast built goodly houses and dwelt therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thy heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not, that he might humble thee and that he might prove thee to do thee good at thy latter end. And thou say in thine heart, my power and the might of mine hand hath gotten me this wealth. Well, Jacob had obviously been humbled, even though God had blessed him greatly. He had obviously had been humbled, and he thanked God, recognized, acknowledged that it was God's grace that had brought this to him undeservedly. Whereas, on the other hand, Esau had a good house, had good food, seemed to have enough of this world's goods that he just didn't have to worry about it in life, and sadly, he forgot the Lord God of his father Isaac and of his father Abraham. And again, this is exactly what Moses warned that generation of Israel. You're getting ready to go into this land that God is giving you because he promised it to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You're getting ready to go into this land. You're going to live in houses you didn't build. You're going to eat out of vineyards and fields that you've not sown, you've not cultivated, you've not done any work to. You're going to drink from wells that you've not digged. You're going to be full. He says, but beware that you don't forget the Lord your God. Well, in a similar way, Jesus talked about how hard it is for a rich man to go to heaven. Matthew chapter 19, verses 23 to 24. And it really should, if we think about this properly, it really should give us also a new appreciation for the trials of the Christian life. We've talked about, as we've been going through, how that there's so much conflict and there's so much hardship and there's so much difficulty. And on one hand, you might say, well, that's some blessing, you know, some blessing that they have received. And again, Jacob still has many, many dark days ahead of him, to where he will come to stand before Pharaoh and say, few and evil have the days of my life been. And he's telling a true story. Well, it should give us a new appreciation for those trials. Where might we be, and what might be our endings if everything were smooth and easy for us and we were always full and always thought we had enough of this world's goods? Well, just like Moses said.